Well, thank you very much, Sarah. And it's very good to be back here in Alma. It's just over 40 years that I first came to this church, and I look around and see one or two people who were indeed here then and are still here now. But of course, the great majority have joined or become members or whatever since then. But thank you for your welcome. It's great to come back and to worship with you. And you are embarking on a series on this subject of suffering. And I have been given this title, What is Suffering? I wonder what sort of a week you've had, or indeed what sort of a year you've had so far. A mixture of good and bad things, of joys and sorrows, of trials and perhaps a few triumphs. I think back over this past week myself. You think of those poor people stranded in Terminal 5 at Heathrow, and how many of them must have felt they were suffering. And they were suffering in some respects, lost their luggage, holiday plans ruined, or arrival home delayed, or whatever it may be. I was cutting my lawn on Thursday afternoon, and suddenly someone appeared on the lawn, and I stopped the mower and spoke to him, and he said, you won't remember me. People often begin conversations like that. But he said, we met 11 years ago, once. And then he told me who he was. And he was the parent of a student in Wills Hall who had died quite suddenly of a brain tumour at the end of his first year as a student. And he said, my wife and I, we were just passing. We've come to look at the tree that was planted in his memory. So I walked over to this tree and we looked at it, beautiful flowering cherry in blossom, and we talked for a few minutes. And I said to him, what about you? Tristram had a younger brother. Yes, that's right. And he's now a surgeon and he's in the Air Force and he's in Basra. And I thought, yes, how much suffering there is going on in Basra throughout Iraq. And in all sorts of places around the world. We live in a world of suffering, and suffering in different guises, different forms, impinges on all our lives. And almost certainly there are some people here this morning who have some acute suffering that they have to bear. Many forms, varied intensity, but something that we all experience. It's interesting, isn't it? If you think of our contemporary, secular, non-Christian culture that we live in, suffering would be invariably thought of, I suggest, as a bad thing, as something that it would be nice to eliminate, and hopefully, perhaps, as progress takes place. Human progress might lead to an alleviation of suffering and the removal of suffering. That would be something to look forward to, for, you know, scientific endeavor might bring that about to some extent. Perhaps education and politics might even do it as well. At least people have thought like that in the past. I wondered if someone was drawing up a Declaration of Human Rights, perhaps later this century. You know, we have a right to life now and a right to freedom, according to the Declaration of Human Rights. Maybe a right to live without suffering. Well, insofar as that is a trend in modern thinking, it's in direct conflict with what the Bible teaches us, isn't it? Because the Bible teaches us that suffering is to be expected. And suffering is not only to be expected for all of us, but it is actually something that we should welcome and we should rejoice in. Romans 5, verse 3, we rejoice in our sufferings. James chapter 1, consider it all joy, my brothers, when you fall into trials, when you face trials of various kinds. And just stop and think for a moment of how extraordinary those verses sound to many of the people around us. And perhaps they startle us a bit when we really stop and think about them. Rejoice in your sufferings. Consider it joy when you face trials and testings. So how are we to understand this subject? Well, the Bible has a great deal to say about suffering all the way through the scriptures. But you know, one interesting thought is that the Bible begins and ends without suffering. There's a lot from Genesis 3 right through to Revelation 21 about suffering. There's a tremendous amount in the Bible about suffering, but not in Genesis 1 and 2, or indeed Revelation 21 and 22. Revelation 21 verse 4, God himself will be with them, his people, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. The Bible is a book with a future focus, and whatever we may feel now, and whoever here this morning may have an aching heart or a tortured mind or a body racked with pain, all this will pass away. And God's ultimate purpose is a creation without suffering. When evil has finally been removed, there will be no more suffering. And we should live with a focus on that future fact. It may seem a rather strange point to begin with, to begin our consideration of this subject. But, you know, let it orientate our thinking. There is indeed a day coming when suffering will be no more, when God's purposes will be fulfilled, and we who are his people will be part of that. A wonderful thought. Focus on future fact. But in the meantime, there is suffering, and we have to live with suffering. Genesis 3 onwards. And the fact that the Bible begins without suffering and ends without suffering maybe should make us reflect in theological terms on what suffering is. The entry of sin into the world, evil arising, as it were, within the midst of God's creation in Genesis chapter 3. Rebellion against God, displacing God, rebelling against his rule and his lordship. That's how the Bible sees evil. Something that is contrary to God's will. Something that is, as it were, contradicting God himself. We perhaps tend to define evil as something that we don't like. Something that doesn't appeal to us. That we think is wrong. But the real biblical focus on evil is that something that resists God's will, his lordship, his rule. And that's partly how we should orientate our thinking. And the consequences of that rebellion in Genesis chapter 3 is that the relationships are broken. The relationship between God and man. The relationships within the human family. And of course also the relationship between man and the rest of God's creation. Man had been made the head of creation, as it were, the leader of the choir of creation, in God's image, in God's likeness, to exercise rule over creation. But when Adam sinned, the ground was cursed. Cursed is the ground because of you, said God. And the whole of creation is in some way marred and spoilt as a result of human sin. Now again, there are no sort of philosophical answers given to us in the Bible, but maybe there are hints and ideas that we should ponder and reflect on. I mean, one idea in contemporary thought is very much that there's a difference between natural evil and moral evil. Moral evil caused by sin and wrongdoing, natural evil, things like earthquakes, tsunamis, or whatever they may be, violent storms. But the Bible is much less sort of clear about such a distinction. The emphasis is very much on God's sovereignty over all. And maybe there's a clue lying in that fact that somehow when man rebelled against God, it wasn't just the human-God relationship that was spoilt, but something happened to the whole of creation. It was spoilt, it was marred, it's been groaning in pain, as Paul puts it in Romans chapter 8, ever since, because the leader of the choir of creation has fallen. The choir can only grind on in discord. Human rebellion has spoilt creation, but God's sovereignty remains, as it were, a fundamental fact about how the Bible views all this. A question often put by non-Christians, of course, is how can an all-powerful God, who is also a loving God, allow suffering? Why doesn't he intervene to stop all this suffering? Well, at one level, the question is misconceived, because it's sort of man putting God in the dock, so to speak, and accusing him. And we cannot do that. We have no right to do that. There are all sorts of wrong answers that can be given to that question, too. One wrong answer would be to say that God is not actually all-powerful. There's no suggestion of that in the Bible. God is sovereign over everything that happens. Another would be to say that God lacks love for what he has made. He doesn't. He loves it. He loves us. He loves his creation to the uttermost. The Bible doesn't give us philosophical answers, but it gives us practical answers. It doesn't tell us, I don't think, why we suffer in the sense of what causes suffering, other than in a very general sense that evil has come into the world through human rebellion and there is a consequence which is suffering spread out on the whole human race and the whole of creation. But not so much a focus on the cause question, but on the purpose question. For what purpose is this suffering taking place? That's a question the Bible has a lot to say about. Not so much looking at the past, the causes, the sort of scientific question, if you may put it like that, but looking at the practical, the purpose question. What should I be learning through this suffering? What is God teaching me through this suffering? And of course, this series will explore that. But here are a couple of thoughts to sort of help as we start. The first is that we suffer in this world, but God suffers too. And that, in a way, when you stop and think about it, is rather remarkable. You would think God, being almighty, when his creation went wrong, he might have just abandoned us and said, well, that's been a failure, we'll forget about them. But of course he couldn't, because he also loved us. And because he loved us and loved his creation, God himself suffers along with us. We get that very powerfully spoken in Genesis chapter 6, where God is reflecting on what has happened and the growth of evil in the world. The Lord saw man's wickedness, how great it had become. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. God's heart filled with pain. God himself suffering on account of evil that had come upon the world. And right through the Old Testament, we see glimpses of that. God is pained by the rebellion of his people. God suffers when his people suffer. And then, of course, supremely, when Jesus comes, God himself incarnate in human form, and he goes to the cross and dies there. And Easter, we were thinking last weekend, the pain of the cross, the awfulness of the cross, the physical pain, the anguish that Jesus endured. But much more than that, the pain of abandonment, of the Son of God being abandoned, crying out, my God, why have you forsaken me? The greatest pain of all, the greatest agony of all time. God himself suffering. God himself crucified and left abandoned, as it were. Think again about Jesus Christ. He had lived a perfect life. He alone knew that direct, constant intimacy with God the Father that none of us have ever experienced because of sin, the effect of sin in our lives. But he knew it. And then suddenly, as our sin was heaped on him, he who knew no sin becoming sin for us, he knew the abandonment as God, as it were, turned his back on his Son and left him. And that speaks powerfully, I think, to us. And perhaps powerfully, too, to those who have suffered that sense of abandonment by God, the victims of the Holocaust. Where is God in this that is happening to us? Or the victims of genocide in different parts of the world, in Rwanda not so long ago. Where is God in what is happening to us? Well, God is suffering along with his people, along with his creation. And God is suffering more intensely than we have ever suffered because of that intimacy that Jesus had always known with his Father. None of the ransomed ever knew how deep were the waters crossed or how dark was the night the Lord went through ere he found the sheep that was lost. And still, you know, there's a sense in which that is true. Do you remember when Saul, who later became the Apostle Paul, on that road to Damascus, and the voice of the Lord from heaven says, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting, not my people, my Christians, but why are you persecuting me? And of course, Saul was embarked, you know, on a great program of persecuting Christians, putting them to death wherever he could, rounding them up, imprisoning them, persecuting them. And Jesus might well have said, why are you persecuting my people? But God's people are his body here on earth now. And he says, why are you persecuting me? And so here's a start with our thoughts about suffering, that God himself suffers with his people. He suffers alongside us here and now, as he did supremely in the cross. But secondly, suffering in the scriptures, especially in the New Testament and in the epistles, is closely linked to glory. Now, if I sort of, you know, if we were doing a word association game and I said suffering, you know, what word is associated with? You might think evil, pain, distress, words like that. You probably wouldn't have, unless you're, you know, very well schooled, as many of you are, of course, in the scriptures and the New Testament, of glory. But if you look at a concordance, you'll find so often in the letters, Peter and Paul, those two words come together. The sufferings of Christ and the glory that should follow. 1 Peter chapter 1, and then later on in 1 Peter chapter 4, rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. I'm a witness of Christ's suffering, says Peter, and one who will also share in the glory to be revealed. Now you may say, well, that's a strange thing. There's nothing glorious about suffering. And that's not, of course, what the Bible is saying. But what the Bible is saying is that these two are closely linked. And that's why we should rejoice in suffering, because it is so closely linked to glory. It was with Christ himself when he died, the sufferings he endured and the glory that followed. After all, it's through suffering that our faith is proved and refined. Peter tells us our faith is tested as by fire, and it's refined as a result of that. Supremely in the Old Testament, and this will probably be one of your case studies later on in this series, the example of Job, who suffered so much as a test of his faith. And of course he came through that test. Though he slay me, yet will I trust him, said Job. Suffering that tests and proves our faith. Consider it all joy when you face various trials, says James. Any kind of trial that may be, testing, because testing produces maturity and it establishes you in the faith, and one should therefore be thankful for it. Suffering involves identification with Christ. It is through suffering that we become sharers and partakers in his suffering. Philippians 1 verse 30. Paul, the Apostle Paul, took suffering as a mark, as a sort of confirmation of his apostleship. I sometimes wonder if Paul had, encountered people who peddle the prosperity gospel. What he'd made of it, what he'd thought of it. The idea that, become a Christian and everything will turn out gloriously right. And, it's even peddled sometimes on the form that you'll become rich and prosperous and God blesses his own and so on and so forth. And that's what you would expect, material prosperity. Christians should fly first class, I heard someone say once, because, that demonstrates that God is blessing you in your life. What a load of piffle, what nonsense. And what would Paul have made of it? The very opposite was his conclusion. The fact that I suffer, the fact that I'm suffering in the way that I am, and he enumerates it sometimes, that shows that I'm an apostle. This is the sort of test, this is the confirmation of it. If we share his sufferings, we will also share